Welcome back to that breaking news.
We start with breaking news.
An Amber Alert.
There is an Amber Alert.
Amber Alert
has been issued.
Before the Amber Alert, there was Amber. Footage of a young girl giving a card to her mom.
Dear Mom, this is for you. I love you a lot. Love, Amber.
In August 1995, a news crew in Arlington, Texas began filming a family.
My daughter worries a lot, but I told her everything will be okay.
Amber rides her bike in a driveway. Then on January 13, 1996, we see the bike on the ground. Subtitle, Somebody Kidnapped Amber. Come and help me. Please find Amber.
This was every parent's nightmare.
That particular time, everybody is a suspect.
We're both innocent. I mean, there's no reason for us to harm our child.
This individual may have committed this crime before.
Who's in our circle? Who's around Amber all the time?
I immediately thought, oh my gosh. She was targeted.
We interrupt this program to bring you the following News 8 special report.
We feel that this tentatively is going to be the body of Amber Hagerman.
After decades of investigation,
the suspect was familiar with not only the abduction site, but the disposal site as well.
We followed thousands of leads.
What's your name again?
Not just hundreds, but thousands.
The mystery remains unsolved.
I believe there are people out there who know what happened.
It would mean a lot to be able to give Donna and Ricky the answer to who killed Amber.
But Amber's legacy lives on.
This is an activation of the Amber Alert system.
Every time I hear an Amber Alert, I say to myself, it's time to go to work, sis. Do your thing.
Everybody knows the Amber Alert. I want the world to know who Amber was.
Amber plays in a sandbox, blows out candles on a birthday cake, lays down looking at the camera, and rides her bike. We see aerial footage of her neighborhood. Title, Amber, the girl behind the alert. We see a suburban Texas neighborhood. Peacock Original, Arlington, Texas. We see the home of Donna Williams, Amber's mother.
I believe this will be my last interview. I'm tired of being sad. I'm broken because my daughter's not here.
She walks through a house.
Normally, I don't have a lot of this out. I normally keep it in plastic totes just to keep it safe, not to get torn up or anything. You know, everybody knows the Amber Alert and what it's used for. I want the world to know who Amber was. She was my dream. She was my everything.
We see a collection of Amber's photos and dolls.
This dress here is Amber's dress that she wore on her 9th birthday, and I just couldn't seem to give it away. Special memories and happy memories for Amber.
Happy birthday to you.
Subtitle, producer, did you ever think it would take this long?
No, I never, ever. I just assumed that he would get caught real quick and it would be done and over with, but it didn't happen that way, so.
She touches a note card attached to a photo album of Amber. Then, documentary producer Pam Curry opens a storage unit. Inside is a banker box labeled Amber.
We started shooting video with Donna, Amber, and Ricky in August of 1995.
She carries the box out of the unit.
There are probably between 200 and 300 tapes and hundreds of hours of video.
She watches a tape.
I don't know that I have a good answer as to why I've held on to him for 25 years.
Pam Curry, WFAA documentary producer.
I think that when you look back in your life, there are a few life-changing moments. I already knew that this was one of them. The fact that we had her alive and people could see her, usually that doesn't happen in a tragedy like this. Then we become an important aspect of that story in deciding whether we were going to release some of the footage that we had, which was exclusive footage.
August 1995, first day of filming, 5 months before Amber is abducted.
Come on.
Amber walks upstairs and waits outside a door.
Richard, please don't.
At the time, I was a single mom with two children, and I was on welfare. They asked me if I wanted to be in the documentary, and the documentary is about how women get off welfare.
Let mommy see, Amber. Oh, you're gonna have to color that. That's pretty. Look. Happy Halloween. When's Halloween? Do y'all know when Halloween is?
What's that? October 31st.
Subtitle, producer, how did they find you?
Well, they found me at a women's shelter.
That's a nice picture.
A lot of us who were working moms felt like that we weren't doing enough stories about what families were facing and how to make things better. We wanted to have someone who fit the national profile, which was a single mom with two children. And it was really hard to find somebody who was willing to do that and willing to share their lives. And I was just about to give up when I got a call from one of my contacts who said, I think I have somebody for you.
I had to think about it for a little bit, but maybe I could help other moms in the same situation I was in and get them on their feet like I was trying to get on my feet. When I was 18, I found out I was pregnant. I was terrified and scared. I waited till she was born, then and I seen her pretty little face, and that's Amber. I thought Amber was a really pretty name, and it just fit her pretty little face.
Archive photo of Amber as a toddler. Subtitle producer, how did you meet Amber's father, Richard?
I just did a lot of walking in the neighborhood. My friends, my girlfriends, and he was out in the yard, and we just started talking, and the next thing I knew, we were together. Of course, he was a lot older than me. He was like 34, basically grew up with him. Then 4 years later, I got pregnant with Ricky. It was wonderful, it was awesome. Amber said, this is my baby, mommy. I said, okay, it could be your baby. So she just kind of put her baby brother under her wing, and that's where he stayed. I was living with their father until Amber was about 7. Ricky was about 2, 3. That's when he really started drinking a lot. Her father was physically abusive to me. He never abused my children. He was just really mean when he was drinking. He used to go out and hang out with his friend Mike Thompson, and they would party and drink together. And then he'll come home, and then he'll drink more and get drunk more. So the neighbors would always call the police because of the noise, and the police will always come. And the police, the last time, the police said, if we come back here again, we will take your children from you. And that's all I had to hear.
You want some fruit, Richard? You want some fruit?
I knew my kids need to be safe. And I just took personal things and just left and never went back. And we stayed in my car for like 2 days in the parking lot. I couldn't go to my parents because he would find us there. And so we just kind of hid out in my car for 2 days. And then we went to the women's shelter and stayed there for about 6 weeks. And they helped me get an apartment and get on welfare and help me get back on my feet.
Archival footage of Donna and her kids, Amber and Ricky.
We were still scared, and every little sound or every little door knock, we would jump to the ceiling because we didn't know if he found out where we stayed at or whatever. And it took almost a good year before we could actually live life again and be happy again.
9 months after moving into her apartment, Donna begins filming with Pam.
They're having a skating party for school, and that's gonna be $3 a piece. I can't do that, so. They're a little upset about that, you know, but we'll save money and next time you can go.
You always have such a positive attitude, no matter how much money you've got in your pocket. You always tell me you're not worried, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
It's depressing sometimes, but I try not to show it, especially in front of my kids. I don't want them to worry.
Archive footage of Donna counting money and standing in school.
I was going to school. I was volunteering at the food stamp office, and my kids were going to school, and they were happy.
That's actually asking a lot for somebody to be that open with us and to share all the hurdles, the ups and downs and frustrations and the trials and tribulations that they go to, for people to have a better understanding of what being in that situation is like. And so it was a journey that I couldn't have predicted. I couldn't have known what would happen.
My daughter worries a lot. She thinks we're going to run out of money, don't have no money for this or that. But I told her everything will be okay. We'll never starve. We'll always eat.
Richard tried so many times for me to come back and move back in with him. And I said, no, I cannot, because I know what's going to happen. If I do that, you'll just go right back to the way you were. Slowly, I let Richard come back into the kids' lives, because that is their father. And like it or not, that's, I had to for my kids. Amber was still a little leery of him. She was still a little scared that maybe he will get drunk again. But eventually that kind of faded away as well. And they were okay together.
Donna reads a book to Amber and Ricky. Text on screen, November 25th, 1995, 2 months before Amber is abducted.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
On her ninth birthday, she had all her friends and had birthday cake and ice cream.
I can wish you blow my baby. All right.
Oh, boy.
She was just bright-eyed and wide-eyed and mouth open like, yay.
Oh, thanks for your bed.
Donna's motivation was that she wanted to make things better for her kids. She was very open with us, and we were part of their family for months. And, you know, felt like they were just part of mine, too.
The party's over.
She's a funny little girl. She takes after her grandpa with that. She always wants to be silly. A very smart, fun-loving little girl.
Subtitle, Donna, videotaping them climbing a tree and stuff. I guess it's what they want. Amber on a playground horse. Subtitle, Donna, yeehaw, ride 'em cowgirl. Hey, I'm recording you, Amber. Blow me sugars.
Blow me sugars.
Amber blows kisses to the camera. Text on screen, January 13, 1996. Donna takes her kids to visit her parents, Jimmy and Glenda Whitson.
Saturday is our family day, so we decided we want to go to Castle Park, and we played there for a couple hours. And then they wanted to come back here to Granny and Papa's house. It was really nice, warm winter days. They were gorgeous days, sunshine in, and everybody was out and about. They decided they want to ride their bicycles, and I told them this would be fine. And so once we got here, they run up to the driveway and said hi to their papa.
3 p.m., Amber and Ricky ride bikes.
And they got on their bicycles and went towards Claudia Street.
Ricky Hagerman, Amber's brother.
Me being the little brother, I'm going to follow her wherever she goes. We would always ride our bikes around the neighborhood, and we did it very often, so I memorized the neighborhood.
And I hollered at him and said, well, y'all stay together, and y'all come right back. And Amber turns around, and she looks at me, okay, Mommy, we will. And that was my last time seeing her or hearing her little voice.
911 operator, Arlington 911, what are you reporting? January 13th, 1996, Arlington. Ricky Hagerman, Amber's brother.
That day, we went to visit our grandparents. And every time we go there, we ride our bikes. We would always ride around the block and come back around to Highland. But that day we took a left where we weren't supposed to go. We went to a abandoned parking lot. They have a little ramp that we can ride down. We were not allowed to go to that parking lot without someone with us. But, you know, kids, we don't always listen, so.
A little girl and little boy ride their bikes down the street.
Something came over me. I got afraid to get in trouble, so I was telling my sister, Amber, let's go back home. Let's go back home. She's like, I'll be right behind you. Just go ahead. So I took off. By the time I got home, I noticed she wasn't behind me. And my grandfather was outside in the garage working. He asked me where my sister was. So I told him, oh, she's over there at the ramps. He grabbed me and put me in the truck, and we went to go look for her.
A bike lays on the sidewalk.
We just found her bike laying there. And that's where it kind of gets a little hazy.
January 13th, 1996, 3:18 p.m. Arlington 911, what are you reporting? Caller, yeah, I saw a black pickup pull up over here on Abram Street and he grabbed a little girl and he took off toward town with her. Operator, what kind of truck was he in? Caller, looked like, kind of like a Ford, but it was a black one. He didn't bother the bike. He just grabbed her and took off. She hollered real loud, cause I could hear it plumb over here. So that's what made me think there was something foul about it. Okay, we'll be there shortly, sir.
There was a witness to this. His name is Jimmy Kettle. He was 78 years old. He lived there on Ruth Street. He described the suspect as a non-African-American male, less than 6 feet tall, of medium build, and clearly of a sufficient strength that he was able to pick Amber up off of the bicycle. Amber's feet never hit the ground. Kevin also said that he just drove at what appeared to be a normal speed across the parking lot. The patrol officer pulled into the parking lot because that's where Jimmy Kevin said that the offense took place. But as it turns out, Jimmy Whitson was there. He's come up there to get his granddaughter, Amber, and there's nothing there but Amber's bicycle. So you've got what Jimmy Kevin told 911, and you've got what Jimmy Whitson told the patrol officer. The patrol officer realizes that we've got a problem here.
Someone exits the screen door of a brick home.
I'll never forget it. Telling my mom.
Ricky looks away from the camera.
My mom coming out the door, expecting all of us to be together, and my grandpa telling my mom that her baby girl's gone. And then she lost it.
So I immediately started running and screaming her name, going towards where she was last seen at. I was just screaming and crying and screaming and crying her name, Amber, Amber, where are you? You know, and a few minutes later, the neighbors were coming outside wanting to know what was going on.
Subtitle, Donna, Richard, if you're there, please come to Mama's. Somebody kidnapped Amber.
I immediately called Amber's father at his best friend, Mike Thompson's home.
Subtitle, Donna, please, Richard. Somebody kidnapped Amber. She's gone, Richard. Come and help me. Please find Amber.
I'm at home on a Saturday. It was my day off, and the telephone rang, and it was dispatch. There was a possible child abduction on East Abram Street in Arlington. My mind just goes into overdrive. Is there a family member that's come and picked up the child? Is there a custody issue? Is it someone that's known to the child that has come and taken them? That used to be a grocery store, and the trucks would pull in and back in, and they'd deliver into the grocery store, and then, of course, the ramp was for the workers to go up and down. Mr. Kevel lived in this residence right here. He was in the backyard doing some yard work, and then he heard a young girl scream. He noticed the pickup truck stopped right there in that area. The driver get out of the truck and grabbed the girl off her bicycle. He exited out the north side of the parking lot and then turned to the west. The interesting thing about going back to the west is it's back toward town. and it's more congested. Speculation was that there was a specific place back to the west. If he was from out of town, I think he would have gone to the east and accessed off 360 to I-30 or I-20.
We see an aerial view of the neighborhood.
I got a call from my husband, and he said, Donna's looking for you. She says she needs your help. So I called her at Jimmy and Glenda's house, the grandparents' house, and I said, Donna, what's going on? She goes, Amber's been taken. And my heart just sunk. I said, okay, I will be right there.
My main focus was to find my baby. I wanted to go look for her. I wanted to go. But my parents are saying, no, you have to stay here. You need to be here if she comes home. Not too long after that, Richard showed up at my mother's house.
Well, there's a lot of things moving in the first 15 minutes of the investigation. At the abduction site, one of the things you do is you take stock and look around to see what all is there, and also specifically what isn't there. Where that truck was sitting, if there was any dirt that would hold a tire impression, if the guy had smoked a cigarette or anything, there was none of that.
We looked around the area and we noticed that there was a laundromat there and that there were people coming and going from the laundromat.
On the west side of the laundromat, which is where she was abducted from, there are no windows. So no one in the laundromat could see anything that was going on. Jimmy Kevel, by far, where he was standing, gave the best vantage point. There's no sense in everybody sitting around that parking lot because she's not there.
Ben Lopez, Arlington Patrol, 1996.
Once the call went out over the radio that we had a child that had been abducted, I started going all over the area looking for the suspect vehicle, which was a black single cab pickup truck. I did pull over a few black pickup trucks in hopes that I would be able to find the suspect and find Amber.
In Texas, pickup trucks are everywhere. Black pickup trucks, you don't really realize how many of them there are until you start looking for them. They're everywhere. It helps narrow things down, but not much. When you look at that area of town, as he goes west on Abram Street, there's a number of places where he can get off, either into a residential neighborhood on the south side or one of these light industrial areas on the north side.
The Browning-Abram area of Arlington, Texas, it's an area of town where people have owned their homes sometimes for 30, 40, 50 years. And so you have a very established group of people that are living there. I would not describe it as a high crime area or a high risk area necessarily.
This type of abduction in Arlington is almost unheard of. The problem it creates for law enforcement is you've got to be able to get it off the ground in a rapid but deliberate manner. There's not much room for error here.
Archival footage of caution tape at the house.
So I got there and I started going under the tape. And of course, the police were like, what are you doing? They had to go ask Donna. She goes, no, I want her to come in. And they were all looking at each other. Why is this reporter just walking into the house like she knows these people? But I did. I knew them. I'd been living their lives with them. We just kept documenting what was happening and being with the family and really showing their side of the story.
On that day, once all the police were involved, everyone was asking me, did you see anything? Did you see anybody? It's very important that, you know, if you did see anybody, anything, just, you know, tell me so we can do something about it. And I didn't have an answer. I didn't see anybody.
If we had only been able to get that word out immediately, then maybe somebody on that street where he turned would have seen him immediately and we could have found her.
January 13th, 1996, 4:30 p.m.
Amber was abducted at about 3:20 in the afternoon. Somewhere around 4:30, the police department contacted the various media outlets and is trying to get them there. But what I truly wish is that there would have been a method that we could have got more information out faster.
D. Anderson, Arlington Police Media Relations, 1996.
I remember I was in shorts and a t-shirt. in January 13th. Even for Texas, that's not common. It was unseasonably warm. And I remember being at home and got a call. They said we had a witness saw a girl get abducted. I said, I'm on my way.
I drove down the streets of this little residential neighborhood, and I could already see all these TV vans just lined up. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is what they mean when they say media circus.
Archive footage of reporters lined up outside Amber's house.
Statistics show that in 74% of the cases where an abducted child is murdered, they're killed within the first 3 hours. So time is of the essence, and getting that information out, you know, to the public is just critical. This was the 90s. The fastest way that you were gonna get out information would be the 6 o'clock news. And so, of course, there was a lag time.
And it doesn't sound like someone that the little girl knew or someone that she was going with voluntarily. We set up a command post out by the residence at her grandparents' house. The media was responding, a huge response. I mean, every station, as far as they could get, had live trucks there.
One of the things we were doing is we're trying to keep track of who was coming to the house, who was coming to the door, who knew Donna, Richard, and the family, and what their relationship was.
The police were asking me, you know, who's in our circle, you know, who's around us, who's around Amber all the time, who's around Ricky all the time. And so that's when we thought about Pam, and I was telling them about Pam Curry in the documentary.
My name is Miss Chris. This is my first grade group picture, and these are my friends in Miss Writing.
We had footage of this little girl alive, not some grainy picture that we were going to slap up. And back then, that's what you did in a tragic news story like this. That's all the family had to rely on, is to throw up a still picture. We put together a clip reel of some of the best identifiable footage that I had from shooting the documentary.
It was heart-wrenching, the video was. I mean, it was her blowing out the candles on her birthday cake. It was her mom putting her to bed. It was her playing Ring Around the Rosie out in the yard with her friends at her birthday party. It was her going to school. I mean, it made her such a person.
I read 89 books.
89?
Uh-huh. I immediately thought, oh my gosh, this is it. Someone saw that on TV, and that she was targeted. You know, they'd seen her on TV. And they said, none of it's air. Not one bit of it's air.
On the day that Amber was kidnapped, we had finished the welfare documentary, and it was going to be airing the next week.
Fairy stories.
Fairy tales.
Fairy tales.
Yeah. I mean, this just touched everyone's heart, and I thought, this is the absolute best break we could possibly get, because everyone's going to remember this.
Archival footage of Amber on her bike.
I won't say it threw us, but it was something that was highly unusual. We'd never been on a case where something already had a television crew following them around taking footage of it. And we used that footage not only to try and give people an idea of what Amber looked like, but also the idea of who Amber was.
Having the footage of Amber really showed the community the person they needed to track down. If they see the black pickup truck, and here's what she looks like, and in her mannerisms.
That made a tremendous impact on the community.
Archival footage of a room full of reporters filming Donna.
Eventually, there were just cameras everywhere. Everywhere I turned, there was a camera in my face.
Don't hurt my baby, please. She's just an innocent child, please. Please bring her home safe, please.
If anybody out there has seen anything, call the police, tell them, let them know.
I was on every camera I could find, begging, please, let my little girl go.
Archival footage of Donna crying.
You know, she's smart. She could find her way home. Just let her go.
Donna hugs her father.
I didn't eat, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't do anything but watch the TV,
beg for him to let her come back home.
Just waiting for her to come in the door any minute now. But she's gone.
It was just a lot of sitting and waiting and just gut-wrenching. It was a helplessness, hopeful still, but she couldn't do anything but just be there.
Archival footage of Donna wiping away tears.
What started out as a welfare documentary that was really focused on Donna and Amber and Ricky turned into a real true crime documentary.
Archival footage of police cars and crews with dogs.
We started getting tips and leads on Amber's abduction almost immediately. As soon as it hit the news, people started calling in with leads.
What's your name again?
We never anticipated the number of leads and calls from the general public that we were going to get.
And then they were also talking to anybody who they considered to be, you know, involved with the family, which included me and my photographers.
The people from the television affiliate, they had quite a bit of footage of her. And of course, one of the things you've got to do in the investigation is find out who they are. Because at that particular time, everybody is a suspect.
It was still a little intimidating that you had to go through that, but you wanted to do what you could to help.
We identified who they were and interviewed several of them. There was no question in our mind that whoever took her had nothing to do with that television crew.
Day two.
I am hopeful. I pray all the time that the little girl won't be hurt. That's all we got to live on right now is prayer.
I have a 5-year-old and a 20-month-old, and I can't imagine it.
I think she's probably really, really scared.
You know, I'm just sitting tight. I don't know what to do. You know, I want to help. I want to go get her, but I can't get her. You know, I don't know where she's at.
Subtitle, producer, prior to Amber's abduction, when was the last time that you had seen Richard? Do you remember?
It was, I think in like 2 or 3 weeks prior to it. But we didn't get along at that time, so we do mostly just phone conversations.
Archival footage of Ricky on the floor, coloring.
I met Richard that night when Amber was kidnapped. It was a little bit of a tense situation because he didn't know what I was doing. He was a little leery of that, as I'm sure anybody would be, but we just kept doing what we'd been doing for so many months.
Subtitle, reporter, when they were doing the documentary, apparently Donna had indicated that she'd been in an abusive relationship. How were things going then?
No, it wasn't abuse. You know, I may have yelled. I may have yelled in the past, but my dad yelled at me and he yelled at my mom. And that's two people trying to work something out.
One of the things that is critical in the opening phases of the investigation is to try and establish the family dynamics. Amber's gone, but we don't know who took her.
Richard, you know, at the time we were battling and we were not getting along, and he was angry with me for leaving him.
Nowadays standards, an argument is violence, and that's not, to me, that's not true. An argument's an argument.
All of these investigative things come into play. It's not a very kind world to live in. The dad's out of the picture. Where was he? Who does he know? You have to just suspect anything and everything at that point.
We're both innocent. I mean, there's no reason for us to harm our child. We want our child back. We want our child found.
January 15th, 1996, day three.
Friends and family continue to post notices and seek clues in the search for Amber.
We're more upset because there's nothing we can do. Nobody knows anything. That's the thing. We can't do anything. You don't know where to look.
A sign reads, "Pray for Amber's safe return." Reporters gather at Amber's house.
Day three, we did not have an individual identified. Of course, in any investigation like this, you just start to corn work out.
Less than 1% of child abduction cases in the United States are stranger abductions, children who are taken by someone that they do not know. The majority of the cases in this country are family abductions.
We're trying to identify Richard's movements for January the 13th. He told us that in the afternoon that he was down at the mini warehouse going to one of the stalls. And we got him on surveillance video, not a care in the world, no idea that anything amiss had happened. But we went down to the mini warehouse and searched it anyway. And of course, there was nothing there.
So without a doubt, we were able to eliminate Richard as a suspect because of him being on video at another location, and he physically could not have been at the location to abduct his daughter.
For a split second, I did think Richard might have had something to do with it. Once Richard got there, and when I seen him up face to face and how much shock he was in that Amber was taken and how confused he was, you know, how can this happen? And I knew right then and there that he had nothing to do with it.
I will say this for him, that when he was interviewed, he bared his soul. I mean, he just, anything we asked, he told us. Because he didn't want us wasting time on that. And the best way to get away from that is to tell us anything and everything we need to know.
Amber, baby, if you're seeing me, if you hear Daddy, we love you. Mama loves you. Miss you. We need you. Once you come home.
I remember thinking that that must have been so hard for her, given theirs had not been, from what she told me, an amicable parting. And so I think she just kept focused on what needed to be done, and she didn't really let any of that get in her way.
I did love him at one point, and he is the father of my two children. I think he knew in his mind that he should be there and he should help support me and Ricky.
It's very typical for law enforcement to immediately interview the family after a child abduction case and then quickly eliminate them and then work on other people that may have had some sort of interaction with the child.
Even though you have every indication, at least initially, that this was a stranger abduction, it doesn't mean that you can just walk away from other potential leads.
A white truck drives down the road.
One of the other things that we look at is the friends of the family. In this case, there was a man named Mike Thompson.
There were people that immediately voiced suspicion about him when they heard what had happened, that there might be some involvement there.
What brings you here this afternoon?
We're gonna take Mr. Thompson with us for a while. We're gonna talk to him some more.
Mike Thompson was frequently part of kind of the family outings and things like that. He'd kind of held himself out to be a family spokesperson if needed.
You're here and you're not hearing anything. It's frustrating. And for Donna, it's more frustrating than to the rest of us.
Especially on a high-profile crime, if we've got someone trying to actively insert themselves in the investigation, one of the first reasons I want to know is why. One of the things that we learned in interviewing Mike Thompson is that he also drove a black truck.
I've got a black truck, so, you know, they have to look. I welcome the opportunity to, you know, do whatever's necessary to show them that they're looking in the wrong direction.
January 15th, 1996, day three, Richard stands outside wearing a pink ribbon.
Got a group of potential suspects that we've identified and people that we're checking on, but whether one of those is an actual suspect or not, it's too early to say.
When Amber was abducted, there were a lot of people coming in and going, and I was just kind of looking at people, you know, do you know where my baby is? I wanted answers. I wanted my baby back home.
Detective Jim Ford, is Mike here? Donna, yeah, they're inside.
Police are still talking with family and friends. Most recently, Mike Thompson. Amber's father stays with Thompson, who also drives a black pickup truck.
Archive footage of Thompson's truck.
Now, how do you know Richard and Donna?
I mean, we've just always been not just a working relationship, but, you know, our friendship develops and you're there for each other.
When you heard the description was a black truck, did you suddenly have the reaction of, why did it have to be a black truck?
I mean, everybody's focusing on it now, but, you know, I got people, there's a black truck. I'm going, the funny part about it, when I first got here on the scene, the first thing Saturday afternoon, there's cops all over here. And I've never once questioned, I've never once asked about my black truck, never, until sometime late Sunday.
Mike Thompson drove a delivery truck and delivered auto parts. And every time he made a delivery, there was a timestamp. And on January the 13th, he was 30 minutes, 45 minutes away. The other part about it was Mike Thompson was friends with Richard. If he wanted to get Amber in the car with him, all he had to do would have been just pull up and ask her. Had it been someone that she knew, why do a blitz attack? There was no attempt at all to engage Amber in conversation, according to Jimmy Kimmel. That's another reason why we believe that it was a stranger, someone that was unknown to Amber. This type of abduction is rare. And of course, on one hand, that's good because it, you know, it means the community is a little safer. But on the other hand, the case incensed the community.
This took over pretty much every aspect of the city and community. It was all about Amber. It wasn't just her neighborhood. It was the entire city, just covered in pink bows. You saw them all over trees and street signs. It was all anyone could talk about.
The community really cared about my little girl and what happened to her.
The waiting's really killing me. It's hard to wait, but I know I had to keep strong for my little girl.
I hope she's okay and she can come back real soon. We all miss her a lot.
How could they not see something? Look how busy this street is.
You see the fear in their eyes, and as a detective, as an investigator, as a police officer, it's very frustrating because you want to be able to take that fear away. You want to be able to solve that crime.
January 16th, 1996, day four.
We knew that a task force needed to be formed that could control the leads and tips as far as making sure that each one was looked at, but again, not doubling the effort.
We were a freestanding task force. We had 15 detectives that they had dedicated to us. I needed people who were very good at interview and interrogation, who had a very strong attention to detail. They didn't let little things slip by them. And I needed people that did not know the meaning of the word quit.
While we were still looking for Amber, these teams of detectives and FBI agents were going out contacting registered sex offenders.
This unit that has come to town has a tremendous amount of expertise in child abduction cases, and that is why they're here.
We assume that because she was 9 years old, and it was a female, that there's a sexual component to this, and that's what drove the investigation. We started looking at sex offenders who had offended against girls in the age range of 7 to 12, and then you expand out from there.
Archival footage of Amber at a playground.
We actually mapped this out on a grid to make sure that we had contacted every resident, if possible. When we interviewed people, we'd find out, do they live there with family? Is it a single male that lives there alone that could potentially be a suspect?
We have every reason to believe that this individual may have committed this crime before.
You have a high-risk grab right there in the middle of that parking lot. You know, in my mind, I just kind of felt like that maybe he had done this before. And of course, it was also a concern that he might do it again in the future.
January 17th, 1996, day five. Donna sits on a bench and cries.
We're just trying not to give up hope and trying to be strong for Amber.
Starting to close.
Would she be willing to talk to me?
You don't have the luxury of dismissing anything. Every lead had to be looked at, no matter how far-fetched or improbable that it was.
A police helicopter takes off.
I remember helicopters overhead. I remember officers with dogs going through the park. Every time they got one of those tips and they went out, you were like, okay, is this it? Are they finally going to find her?
And I think they're working as hard as they can, and I think they're doing all they can to get Amber home.
Women hold hands in a circle.
Give them peace. Give them hope that it will end in a happy reunion.
I didn't know what to do. All I knew I wanted to do was get my little girl home. I worried about her the whole time. You know, is she gonna get fed? Is she being taken care of? Is she warm? Is she cold?
Aerial footage of the city at night.
You know, the days go on, the hours go on, and you don't have to know much about child abduction statistics to know that every second works against you. Not just every minute or every hour, but every second works against you. the chances of finding a child alive diminish dramatically as time goes on.
Arlington 911, what are you reporting? Caller, yes ma'am, my neighbors are yelling right now. They're saying they found the little girl's body that they're looking for. January 17th, 1996, day five, we see footage of storm clouds.
Wednesday evening, this spring-like thunderstorm came through and dropped the temperature. I mean, for as warm as it was, it turned off just bitterly cold out of the north. But as the front moved through, which it does typically in Texas when cold air meets warm air, we have bad, bad storms.
911 operator, what apartment complex is this? Caller, it's blank. The man from next door came up here and they knocked on the door. And they said, we think we found the little girl and my husband went back out with them. They were concerned though, I think because there's water in the ditch, they're afraid she's gonna, you know, wash away with the current. My husband's out there, he won't let her go. 911 operator, okay, so if it comes to that then he'll hang on to her. Caller, absolutely. 911 operator, okay, and we do have our ambulance crew and everybody on their way out there.
I received a phone call at about 11:30 at night at my residence. Dispatch informed me that a body had been found in Arlington.
Archival footage of an ambulance arriving on the crime scene.
I was the first investigative person that was on the scene. Patrol was there and crime scene was there.
We don't know that much at this point, and we want to be very, very cautious about the information that we're putting out.
I walked down to the creek bed and I noticed a young white female's body that was floating but was caught up in the brush.
The police are saying it's too hard to tell, you know, who knows her. My husband's said it was a female. She's naked. She's butt naked. She's face down. Who said it was female?
Police with flashlights search behind caution tape.
Why has the lead investigator on the Amber Hageman case been called here?
Well, I mean, he's one of our lead homicide investigators, and we're certainly sensitive to the fact that we've located a body that needs to be identified. I mean, I don't want to, you know, alarm anyone at this point, but we're certainly sensitive to the fact that it could be Amber, and we're just not in a position to say yet.
Has the family been notified in any way?
We have people en route over to the residents now to notify them that we have located a body.
Archival footage of Amber's house.
My name is Darilyn Perryman, and I was the victim assistance coordinator for the Arlington Police Department during the Amber case. I go into the house and touch base with the family. I had been given instructions that we weren't going to be able to positively identify the child that was found until they completed the crime scene investigation.
I had been with the family all day, and I got in bed, and I had hardly touched the sheets before the phone rang. And I picked up the phone, and it was my assistant news director, and he said, Pam, they found a body. So I immediately headed back to the house and went straight in with my photographer.
Pam walks through the house.
We were all really watching the news, and they kept talking about this little body they found.
So Edie Coker and her husband, who found the body, Stuart Coker, are at least themselves convinced that what he saw was the body of a young girl. Police are not so convinced.
So we sat in their living room, and they had the news on all night long.
It was over and over and over, a child's body's been found, it's probably Amber, it's probably Amber. And so you can imagine how agonizing that was to just sit there and listen to that.
Archival footage of Donna on the couch watching the news.
We interrupt this program to bring you the following News 8 special report.
Arlington Police Department came to the house this evening to tell the family that a body had been found. Amber's father also is here at the house with a family.
I was watching this on the news in my parents' home with my parents, and that was hard.
Family friend who has been here throughout the whole ordeal, as well as Amber's mother, who is looking quite distraught.
It was an excruciating night, and though I wasn't her family, I felt like I understood, and I was having some of those same emotions. I didn't want it to be her. Nobody did.
What I saw was the little girl riding her bike, and then a black pickup pulled up next to her and yanked her off that bike.
I was in contact with Mike Simons, and he said it was probably Amber, but we needed to be sure, and we didn't want to tell them until we had confirmed that it was actually her. So I talked to the family. I explained that to them.
Well, at this point, I'm telling you, you've got a couple of hours to rest. If you can even just close your eyes for a couple of minutes, that's going to help a little bit.
Archival footage of Donna and Richard on the couch.
I was there for several hours, and then my pager went off, and I went out to the car. I did have a cell phone, and Mike Simons said, yes, you know, we've identified it's her. They had identified some birthmarks. And then he said, and you have 5 minutes to tell the family before we announce it to the media.
Archival footage of Richard and Donna entering the house at night.
There was a scream and a cry that I will never forget.
As far as our investigation right now, we have...
Richard and Donna embrace.
That was really, really hard. You know, just looking at my mom and my dad crying, and my dad never cries.
Donna watches on the news as police officers take a body into a van.
From all visual that we can see, from the description that we've got and from the photographs we've seen, we feel that this tentatively is going to be the body of Amber Hagerman.
We are in the process of notifying the family as such. We are stressing to them, and I want to stress to all of you, that a positive identification will be made to the medical examiner's office.
Just the agony of knowing that, yes, that was her, and she was gone. You can't even describe it.
You know, very little to go on as far as suspect information, as you all know.
January 18th, 1996, the morning after Amber's body is found.
We decided pretty early on that we're going to have to not air the welfare documentary, which was due to air on Thursday. And actually, that was the day we found out she was found.
Archival footage of Donna hugging Ricky.
When they confirmed it was Amber's body, you know, everybody's screaming and crying. The news media is everywhere. The police are putting the yellow tape around my parents' front yard. It was horrible that day.
Archival footage of caution tape around a pink ribbon.
And still, I'm in denial. No, it's not my baby. I want to see my baby from my own eyes. I wanted to touch my baby. I wanted to talk to my baby. And I did not know. I did not believe it.
Archival footage of Pam with Donna and Ricky.
Immediately, of course, Donna wanted to go and be with Amber. And as a mom, I could certainly identify with that. If I hadn't been able to put my hands on my child for several days because they were missing, that would be the first thing I would want to do too. The Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Office doesn't allow people to visit. We contacted the medical examiner's office, and of course they did the autopsy priority because we knew that it was just urgent. You know, she really, really needed to be with Amber.
Archival footage of Donna hugging Ricky. Then we see an FBI agent searching near a river.
Now we have a homicide. First order of business, you shift into high gear, thinking, okay, what have we got? That started off Saturday. Now we're over here on Thursday. We found Amber dead in this creek 3 miles away. Why?
Ben Lopez drives through Arlington. Ben Lopez, Arlington Patrol, 1996.
So right now we're pulling into the apartment complex and we're going towards the creek that runs north and south along the west side of the apartment complex. The first time that I came out here, it made me realize that the suspect must have known that this apartment complex and the creek were here. It just doesn't seem likely that a suspect would just randomly drive into this complex and then just happen upon a creek to leave her body in. The night that Amber's body was found, there were thousands and thousands of gallons of water that washed over her body. Based on the condition of her body, we think that she was put in very close to, if not exactly where her body was found. There were not injuries or anything like that that would be indicative of her traveling a long way in the water, hitting rocks, hitting branches, and all the things that you would expect to see if she had been put in the water a long ways from where she was found.
It was a large apartment complex, and there was a main gate. To the west of that main gate, there was another entrance. It too had a gate. At the time of Amber's abduction and her recovery, that gate was broken. So there was unfettered access into and out of the apartment complex through that gate. There was a video camera at the main entrance. On the night that Amber's body was recovered, the wind and the rain was shaking the camera and it took visibility down to where we couldn't see very well.
You can see vehicles coming and going, and you do see a dark truck that enters the complex, but the video just wasn't clear enough to be able to determine whether or not that was the suspect vehicle.
There was nothing on that video that we could use to identify a suspect. One of our beliefs was that the suspect was familiar with not only the abduction site, but the disposal site as well. And that's another one of the reasons why we believed that he was probably a local resident.
Archival footage of a man addressing reporters.
The only portion that was submerged was from her shoulders up, and maybe an arm. And so I ran back to the house and broke through the front door and yelled at my wife, Edie, I found her, I found Amber.
Stuart Coker was the witness that found Amber's body that night. His statement was that after the storm had passed through the area, that he took his dog out for a walk. His dog went down to the creek bed area and began barking. Then he saw Amber's body.
And because there'd been so much coverage of Amber being missing and everybody trying to find her, his immediate thought was, that's probably her.
You ask all sorts of questions like, did you talk to anybody while you were going out to go on this walk? What'd you do before that? If he was involved in it, then obviously you're worried about what happened from the abduction time to the discovery of the body. There wasn't anything in his story that was inconsistent. He was finally eliminated by a polygraph.
We're just going to question people, see what they saw and what they observed.
We began a canvas. Multiple FBI agents, and we had multiple Arlington PD detectives there.
We want to know who the maintenance people are, who is doing the landscaping at the apartment, what independent contractors they have. We went door to door. Before it was over with, we were at every single apartment in that complex.
We didn't find any additional witnesses. No one admitted to seeing anyone parking and carrying anything down through the playground into the culvert area, either that night or any of the days leading up to that.
A vehicle drives through a suburban street in Arlington. Text on screen, January 19, 1996. 2 days after Amber's body is found, Donna is allowed to see her.
I didn't believe that was Amber. I said, that's not my baby. My baby's not dead. You know, I want to go see my daughter. Take me to my little girl. I want to hold my little girl. I want to see for myself with my own eyes that this is my little girl. And they kept telling me, no, I can't, because they had to do the autopsy. And then she was so disfigured, so they had to cover her wounds up so I wouldn't see that. And they said I didn't want to see her the way she was. And I told him, I don't care. I want to see my little girl. I want to hold my little girl.
So I didn't get to see her or hold her until the next day. And they took me to the funeral home. I got to kiss her and hold her hand and told her that everything's okay, you know, mommy's here. So they told me I could hold her hands and touch her little face, and that was it. But I so wanted to, you know, pick her up and hold her.
Donna starts to cry.
Yeah.
Archival photo of Donna and Richard standing beside Amber's coffin. The funeral home is full of stuffed animals.
Amber had a very severe laceration to her throat from one side to the other. It was a very severe cut, very violent cut.
You've got all this damage to her throat, the neck area, but not necessarily a tremendous amount of damage elsewhere on the body.
One of the things that we saw right away was that there was no indication of a sexual assault to Amber's body. Just because there's not evidence of a sexual assault doesn't mean that there was not a sexual component to it.
You can't escape at least the theory that the act of killing Amber was what provided a sexual release for the suspect. There were some very, very early signs of decomposition that were identified that would be more consistent with the idea of her being killed Tuesday going into Wednesday. There was no signs of torture. There was no signs of restraint, no defensive wounds that we could see. Question now becomes, all right, where would she have been kept alive? Who did this? How did he hang on to her?
January 20th, 1996, 3 days after Amber's body is found. Text on screen, Reverend Ann Stevens, associate pastor.
We wonder what kind of monster could commit such a horrible deed.
Well over 2,000 people showed up to her funeral.
It was standing room only. There were so many people there because this had just touched a community like you can only imagine.
It just so overwhelming, and as a mom, you're trying to grieve for your little girl.
Archival photos of Amber and Ricky fade to mourners at Amber's funeral.
Really, the last thing I remember is just the funeral. Not really when they found her body, and I just remember the funeral. At 5 years old, I didn't know what death was. I was telling her, wake up, sissy, wake up. It's time to get up.
Mourners line up at Amber's casket.
To me, I just wanted to take my baby and just run. You know, I got my kids. You know, it's just, that was a little part of me wanted to do that.
People cry as pallbearers carry Amber's casket out of the church.
I attended the funeral. It was to go to observe the participants and see if anything looked unusual, if anyone acted inappropriately, if someone just looked out of place.
Sometimes a suspect will want to go to the funeral just to see what's going on. Of course, the issue with Amber's funeral is there were lots of people there. This wasn't a family affair.
We put surveillance inside and at the graveside during the services, and then we also had people surveilling the outer perimeter around the area to see if someone was on the outskirts, possibly observing from a distance. We felt like we had to do anything and everything that could possibly provide new information and lead to the suspect that killed Amber.
People carry pink balloons outside Amber's funeral. January 23, 1996, 6 p.m. News, 3 days after Amber's funeral. Donna and Richard speak to reporters. Subtitle, Donna, and we also especially appreciate all the children. All the little letters, all the little drawings. Richard, it just overwhelmed us that we didn't know this community was that tight. We really didn't know it was that tight.
My parents were with every newscast asking for help, putting out information to bring justice to their daughter.
Subtitle, reporter, obviously there's an intense investigation. Are you frustrated by the fact that he hadn't been caught?
It makes me mad because I don't know. I want to know. I want to know now.
Donna had been on camera with us for a while, but there was a change in her demeanor as the days wore on.
I'm just slowly, surely losing all my hope that they're going to find him.
Archival footage of police searching a field.
We were hopeful early on, of course, that there were more witnesses and that people would come forward. And we've just been tremendously frustrated by that fact that this abduction occurred in broad daylight on a very busy street on a Saturday afternoon and no one saw anything.
We would hold 2 briefings daily for the press to keep the information flowing. And there were many times, and I didn't have anything new to say, but I went in there and did it anyway.
Okay, describe the truck to me.
We certainly felt like we had to keep this case of all cases in the public eye. We'd followed thousands of leads, not just hundreds, but thousands.
January 24th, 1996.
We've got a couple of tips that on some vehicular traffic and some people that were seen in the area.
There were calls coming in on a regular basis of people that thought they'd seen or thought they'd seen the suspect.
Now, those leads ranged from everything from I saw a black pickup to specific suspects that were named right away.
There was a woman that came forward and said that she had seen the entire abduction.
The witness went so far as to describe the Ford splash as well as a partial license plate number that she thought she remembered, and she saw Amber in the passenger seat of this truck, and Amber was banging on the back window like she was asking for help.
Four days after Amber's funeral.
We really hadn't had any good leads. And a woman came forward, though, at that point and said she had a partial license tag.
Because she gave a much more specific description of the pickup truck, we developed a whole investigative strategy that was kind of based around what she said.
Everybody on the task force is excited. We finally got the detail that will lead us to the suspect.
At that point in time, we had been working with the Ford Motor Company, and they came up with a list of potential trucks with a partial plate that had been sold in this geographic area that matched that general description of that truck.
Detectives end up finding a potential suspect, and he actually lives in Arlington within the range of where the suspect would have gone.
My hopes were really up high, and finally we're going to get justice for Amber, and we can close this chapter, and it's all going to be done with.
A police officer looks at a license plate.
Now we think we've finally got the break that we need.
An officer speaks to someone at the door.
The man cooperated and let detectives search his house. And there was nothing whatsoever to indicate that he was a suspect in it.
After this happened, the detectives went back to contact the witness and basically go over the whole story again with her. And they started putting 2 and 2 together, and it just wasn't adding up. The information that she was providing us really wasn't matching what we had been able to corroborate. We interviewed her again, and then she finally admits to us that she didn't know anything and she just made it up.
She made the story up because she felt so bad for Donna and the lack of a break in the case that she just wanted to do anything that she could to help her. And I know how that sounds, but for some reason, this lady thought that this would be helpful to Donna and make Donna more hopeful that a suspect was going to be found.
She thought that giving us that type of information might spur us on some sort of renewed energy into the investigation. But instead, what she did was she cost us time and she cost us man hours. And quite frankly, she pissed me off.
People gather at a memorial.
We had a lot of people that would come up with false information just to bring Amber's case back up. It was very frustrating, not just for me, for the police as well.
Prosecuting her for making a false statement wasn't going to help us any. I wanted to keep everybody focused on Amber.
We felt very early on that it was a stranger abduction. You know, every sign pointed to that. We begged for someone to come forward that knew anything. Just another tool in the toolbox, trying to use it to get some help. Everything that happened along the way was just a step-by-step situation where we were just frustrated at every turn. And it was tough. It's very tough.
Donna looks at photos of Amber.
A couple of weeks after I buried Amber, I just assumed, you know, you're the police. You're going to solve this. You're going to be able to come and tell me who murdered and who butchered my little girl. And there was just no evidence.
February 20th, 1996. People stand at a memorial wall for Amber.
How do you feel about the fact that they haven't found somebody?
I'm frustrated, angry. You know, why can't they find this man? You know, how hard can this be, you know? Of course, I was frustrated and angry because they couldn't find my little girl. And now I'm frustrated and angry because I can't find him that did this to her.
Donna became convinced that whoever took Amber had done something like this or similar to this before, and it just angered her that they were still out there and that they could have done it again.
From the moment that Amber was abducted and the anguish Donna was going through, over the course of time, she turned that into a drive, a sense to make a difference and to give the police greater tools.
Not every family that has an abducted child will then turn their energy into advocacy. Donna was going to fight for Amber, and she was going to make sure that this would not happen to any other child.
City council meetings were all about Amber. You would have hundreds of people going up there wanting to talk. School board meetings, the same thing.
There are 77 million parents out there who want their children to be safe. All we have to do is organize. All we have to do is work together. All we have to do is send the message, and then things will...
Donna, her life is open to the public, period, at this point, because of what happened.
Subtitle, Donna, I'm fighting for Amber. I know she's gone now. It's not going to help Amber, but it will help her friends. It will help all the other children.
The important thing, as we followed this path that really had been set out for us, was that we tell what it was really like to live through something like this. It's usually very personal, but Donna was willing to share that with everybody.
Archival footage of a candlelight vigil for Amber, March 11th, 1996.
This is Donna Whitson.
Archival footage of Donna at nursing school. Subtitle, Pam, this is a big step for you to take. Donna, yeah, it's a really big step. It's hard, but something I have to do.
When Amber was abducted, I was going to medical school, so I took a leave of absence.
Donna hugs her colleagues.
I had to finish for her, and I did.
You see her going from devastating grief of losing that child and dealing with that reality to the other end of the spectrum, and was able to continue on for Amber.
October 1996, 9 months after Amber's abduction and murder.
Why is it taking so long? It shouldn't take that long, you know. Why can't you find this black truck? Why can't you find this monster?
Subtitle, Mark Simpson, strategy-wise, we've got some more things that we're going to try. We're re-hitting some of the subcontractors that were working up here in the residential area. We see rows of black binders. Donna, looks like you've got more books. These are tips. Mark Simpson, all of them.
The whole room was just packed full of stuff about Amber's case. It was like, wow, this is overwhelming.
Mark Simpson, you call that lady over in Dallas. Donna, oh yeah, I'm excited about that. They're gonna name it after my daughter, the Amber's Plan. I think it's great.
When Amber was taken, a lot of people said, if we could have just gotten the word out, there would probably be a better chance that she could have been found.
It is the desperate search for this little 9-year-old, and time is of the essence. And so tell everybody in the community this has happened, give them information, the photographs, the video, here's the suspect vehicle, and then really engage to get everybody to help search.
I think that was in a lot of people's minds is, can we do this? How can we do this? And how can we put that into action? Deanna Simone was one of those people who could see that that was a good possibility.
I am Deanna Simone, and I am resident of Fort Worth, Texas. I rarely, if ever, watched the news, but the TV was on, and as I passed by it, I noticed what appeared to be somebody's home video was on. There's such a different emotional reaction when you see a child opening presents and riding a bike and waving and smiling than you do just a flat picture. This child becomes very real to you. Then to hear this horrifying situation had taken place, you just immediately think what her mother must be feeling.
Archival footage of Amber and Ricky playing in the yard.
In Amber's case, she was taken around 4 o'clock. It was 6 or 6:30 when I saw it. So 2.5 hours had already passed before the public became aware of what was going on. I called the radio station and I said, I'm calling about the Amber Hagerman case. And she said, do you have any information? And I said, no, I don't, but I do have an idea.
So often when children were being taken, it was by a suspect in a vehicle. Put the child in the vehicle, they drive off. So wouldn't it be great if there was a way to let everybody know about it so that they could be your eyes and ears on the street looking for that suspect vehicle, looking for that suspect, looking for that child? Arlington police and this group of radio station managers ended up getting together and formulating this plan for this emergency broadcast alert that they would put out. And it would have a loud, obnoxious sound. It was going to go out on the radio stations and would alert people that there had been a child abduction, give them information like, where did it happen? What does the suspect look like? What is the suspect driving?
It's so simple, it's brilliant. Because the whole idea is to be able to get out to the public information that they can use to provide us with actionable intelligence. A description of suspect, description of a vehicle, license plate, something that they could work with.
It's a real partnership. It's a partnership between law enforcement and broadcasters to work together when time is critical on a serious child abduction case.
October 30th, 1996.
Today we're unveiling the Amber Plan.
And I encourage all radio stations to participate in this because it is a great idea. And it will get information out that we need to get our little girl, our little boy home.
Some staggering percentage of people had their radio on when they were in the car. And so we thought if we could get it across all the radio stations in Dallas-Fort Worth, just think how many eyes we'd have out looking for the kids. And so it just worked like a charm as far as getting people to say yes. And then Ray Lee Bradbury comes along.
November 1998, 3 years after Amber's abduction and murder.
We got a call that there was a missing baby by the name of Ray Lee.
We are living in Arlington throughout my whole pregnancy. I knew everybody, I loved everybody, and I had this little lady, she's cute as could be, her name was Sandra Fallis. I thought of her as a friend, and I trusted her. So that's why I felt like that it was a good choice that I let her become my babysitter. I drop her off that morning in a little onesie nightie, and then her diaper bag full, and then just do a normal 8-hour work day.
And then when evening came time and the babysitter was supposed to show up with her, they didn't show up.
A woman knocks on a door and sees a diaper bag.
I didn't think she was kidnapped. That's not a word that I would even associate. No local hospitals had heard of any wrecks or anything like that. And then finally, I just decided to call 911. I'm like, my babysitter hasn't brought my baby home. Basically, a police came up and he was like taking the report and stuff.
And we started talking about, well, is this the time we should do this? We felt like, okay, you know, something's gotta happen. We gotta get this baby back. I remember calling the police chief, I'm getting ready to do this.
They're like, we're going to use this thing called the Amber Alert.
A tape labeled Amber's Plan is put into a machine. A radio station goes on air.
This is an activation of the Amber Alert system at the request of the Arlington Police Department. Arlington police say a child, a 2-month-old white female baby, has been kidnapped. The baby's name is Raylee Ann Bradbury. Police believe the victim was abducted by her babysitter, Sandra Joyce Fallis, a white female, 42 years of age, 5'3". 135 pounds with black hair, brown eyes, and driving a turquoise 1993 Ford Ranger splash pickup truck.
It literally was like 30 minutes, and we got the call.
911, what is your emergency? Caller, that Amber Alert. The lady's right in front of me. Caller, that Amber Alert. The lady's right in front of me. ES-3949 splash pickup with a wood bed on it. I'm on Interstate 20, fixin' to cross 1382 going westbound. She's got the baby sitting in the front of her.
Got driving down the highway next to her, looking in the vehicle. I see the baby sitting on the front seat, in her car seat.
Caller, that's her. I can't believe it.
So we got a patrol officer out there, pulled her over, got the baby.
Archival footage of police arresting a woman and taking a baby in a bassinet.
I was in the car driving home, and I was elated. I was absolutely elated. I mean, there are no words, you know, because you're just like, oh my God, it's working. It's absolutely working.
When I was finally able to hold her, it was a relief. It was just an overwhelming relief. I didn't want to let her go. I was not going to let her go.
It couldn't have happened any better. So, yeah, a happy ending to a thing rooted in a terrible tragedy.
That was awesome. Me and my mom, we just kind of looked up in heaven and said, you did it, girl.
I've said how much Amber Hagerman has meant to me, and it's true to this day. I wouldn't be here without her. I used to call her my guardian angel. I used to pray to her, just like little prayers, like, thank you for this day, like, thanks for watching over me.
Every time I hear an Amber Alert, I say to myself, it's time to go to work, sis, do your thing. I just wish that Amber had something in place at the time.
It's bittersweet. What if we had an Amber Alert when Amber was missing? Could it have saved her life?
Archival photo of Amber posing by a car.
Once other areas across the country heard about the program, they said, well, we're going to set one up in our town.
Within weeks of us activating Amber, I was receiving calls and other people were receiving calls from around Texas and from around the United States on, okay, how do you do this? I would walk them through the process that we went through in developing the relationships with their radio stations and actually putting it in place and getting it up and running.
We have a critical time that we have to get this information out to galvanize the community, to get their ears and eyes looking everywhere for the child, for the vehicle. It was exciting to see the programs popping up around the country. And it was in 2000 that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children said, you know what? We should take this national.
And then to just see it, I mean, just explode. It just becomes just this phenomenon, and it works.
April 30th, 2003, 7 years after Amber's abduction and murder.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
President Bush signed on and said, you know, I support this. And he designated a National Amber Alert Coordinator at the Department of Justice.
Amber Hagerman, whose mom is with us today. A good Texan, I might add.
George Bush looks at Donna in the White House Rose Garden.
Was 9 years old when she was taken away from her parents. We're acting today in her memory. And in the memory of so many other girls and boys who lost their lives in innocence and acts of cruelty. And now it is my honor to sign the PROTECT Act of 2003.
That was sort of the crowning moment, and I get chills, because everybody's work had paid off.
President Bush signs a bill and shakes Donna's hand.
It was nerve-wracking, but I was still really proud because the president is talking about my little girl. And I was able to talk to him about my little girl and what happened to her.
A sign reads, "Don't forget Amber."
Donna really evolved. She turned her grief and anger into advocacy.
She's been a champion of the Amber Alert program the entire time. And she knows that, you know, this is her daughter's legacy.
We see aerial footage of Arlington, Texas, January 13, 2021, 25th anniversary of Amber's abduction.
Tragedy struck this community January 13, 1996. Our resolve to solve this case has not wavered.
Anytime there's an anniversary of her abduction and murder, and there's a press conference or a memorial, we have a bunch of community members come out in support of the family.
This case is personal to me because I've been involved in some aspect since the day that Amber was abducted. In 2010, I became the lead detective, and I had the case from then until 2018 when I promoted to sergeant. At that time, Detective Grant Gildon took over as the lead detective.
Actually, I was a sophomore in high school when this case happened. And I remember hearing of the Amber Alert and that it was named after a young girl that was kidnapped and murdered. It wasn't until I was applying with the Arlington Police Department that I became aware that the case originated in Arlington, Texas. I saw just how passionate they were about trying to solve Amber's case. Then it really struck me that that was something I wanted to help contribute to.
Figure we gave of 5,500, that's the number of leads the Amber Hagerman Task Force investigated between February of 96 and June of 97. Current to date, we've investigated over 7,000.
The 25th year anniversary is just another year with no answers, no justice, and we want that change. We want justice. That's our goal. That's what we need. Our family needs closure.
One of the major issues with a case that is a long-term case like this is that, you know, people forget about it. But Amber's killer is out there somewhere.
We see windmills and oil derricks in rural Texas. A van drives down an isolated road through wheat fields. October 2021.
After 25 years, of course it gets frustrating at times because we want to solve the case and we want answers for Amber's family. But as homicide detectives, we never let that frustration get to us to the point of quitting.
Recently, there was some new technology that I became aware of that we thought was relevant to some of the evidence that we've maintained in this case. We've started to discuss the possibility of testing some of the evidence we have that we hope can produce DNA in this case.
With Amber, there is just not much trace evidence at all.
The main question when determining what evidence to test and what kind of testing to do is thinking about the quantity of the evidence and whether or not you're going to use up or consume all of the potential DNA while doing the testing.
Is it worth the risk of destroying all the evidence in the testing process? Or is it something we should wait a few months to test because of the advancements in the technology that are taking place very rapidly?
The motivating factor for me is thinking of Amber's mother and also Amber's brother and how he has grown up and just wanting answers from that day. I believe that the person who kidnapped and murdered Amber Hagerman is still alive. If we continue to work this case, we will be able to bring them to justice. I also believe there are people out there who know the details about what happened. That's why we continue to take every lead and investigate it as thoroughly as possible in hopes that one of these leads will eventually lead us to the killer.
Arlington detectives are currently working with a private lab to determine if DNA technology has advanced enough to test some of the evidence from Amber's case. They have still not decided if this is the right time.
Hold me up, Daddy. There we go.
Ricky holds a baby.
This is my daughter, little Gracie Renee Hagerman. So we gave her Amber's middle name, Renee. She was actually born on the same day as Amber, November 25th, and in the same hour.
My son is happy. I want to cry every time I see my son because he is so happy. He is in a good place now. It makes my heart good to see him happy.
Donna holds Ricky's baby.
So life is okay now.
February 2022, 26 years after the final day of filming.
Oh my gosh, how are you doing?
Donna hugs Pam.
It's so good to see you, too.
There was a little bit of nervousness about how she would feel and I would feel after so long a time. But when I saw her, it was one of those situations where you felt like no time had passed away at all.
Yeah, I'm on my dad's gonna make the show.
But it's such an honor to have been a part of what happened and where we are today. And I know that Donna wants to continue to look at that. Every time a child is saved, that makes a difference to her. And it makes a difference to me too.
Archival footage of Amber on Monkey Bars.
The main reason why I'm doing this documentary today is to kind of let people know what kind of little girl Amber was. She's always helping other little children and taking care of children. And she always took care of her little brother. So this is just another way for her to do that. She's still doing what she loved.
Archival footage of Amber.
She was not just a victim. She was my daughter. She was somebody. She is somebody still today.
Over the closing credits, we see a montage of news footage. The captions all relate to children being found as a result of Amber Alerts. Closing credits, executive producers Ricky Stern, Annie Sundberg. Title cards for Lucid, Breakthrough Films, and Peacock. The Amber Alert has saved more than 1,000 children. If you have any information on the murder of Amber Hagerman, call Crime Stoppers of Tarrant County, 817-469-TIPS, 8477.